Hello YouTubers, if you're like me, you're at home because of the virus, and so I thought I'd give you something to watch. And what happened was, last week, at the end of a test day at Silverstone, Racing Wolf came and interviewed me and just asked about my coaching and got some advice on just general stuff. It was an hour, over an hour, actually. So what I've done, I've just put the interview up now, so if you just keep watching, you can see the whole interview. Hopefully this gives you something to do and it will help you in some way for 2020.
Hi everyone, this is me, Racing Wolf. Welcome back to my channel, and today I am with the gentleman whose name ends in Mucci.
Am I correct? Pronounced it right, yeah. It's Mucci like Gucci, like a handbag.
We had a 3 weeks preparation, so I had the time.
It's hard to find that, actually. Dictionary doesn't know it.
Enzo, I remember very quickly.
Yeah, keep it at that.
Yeah.
Forget a second, though.
Enzo, thanks a lot. First of all, we tried to arrange it for like many weeks.
Yeah. Well, I first met you at the sponsorship summit from Tom Oliphant.
Yeah, so from Tom Oliphant.
When was that? November?
No. End of November.
Yes, it's been a long time.
Yeah, but, yeah. I think it was straight after the Kartmania. I think so.
Yeah.
Enzo, thanks a lot for make it happen, you know.
Yeah, no worries.
Yeah, I'm really happy that we have this. I don't want to call it interview because it's not the interview. It's just something like
chat.
A camera chat.
Yeah. No worries.
And so I have a question.
Go on.
I prepared a few questions for you, and first of all, I would like to find out how your motorsport career started. How everything started in your life with the motorsport.
Okay. Well, motorsport was, I think it was quadding. You know the quad bikes?
Yes.
Four wheels?
Yeah.
And I used to go to the Sunday market. Now, you know what one of them is? A car boot sale.
Yes.
And they had this track there, and I was probably, I don't know, 8 years old or whatever. And that's where it all really started. And I used to jump on that every single Sunday. So I always had that sort of, it needs to be on a motor. I don't care what it is. So the first love was quadding. Could never afford to race them, didn't even know where to start, and then it just stayed sort of inside for a long time. I got to high school, and then I fell in love really with F1, and that was the dream, as every kid is, it's F1, and I didn't really know where to start. Had no karting whatsoever apart from arrive and drive go-karts, just jump on and do some kind of corporate event or whatever. And I did well in them straight away, so I thought I was the next Nigel Mansell, who was my dream. And then I got to 16 years old, and I entered a scholarship, and they said, you're too young to win, but come along and we'll let you drive the Formula Ford and all this, and it was at an airfield. And the winner got a free season, but I could just be there just to have a go in the car, and that was it. That's when it really bit. It's like, this is it.
What?
This is what I love. It was a Formula Ford car. So this was back in the mid-90s, so some time ago. And then actually I got my license when I was 18, sorry, this was 1994, at the Jim Russell School.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that? It used to be...
I came to UK in 2005.
Well, Jim Russell was a really good school. It was like $2,500 to pay for it, and it was 1 week of intensive training. Every day you were on track, and on the seventh day, you had a race meeting, so all the students had a race against each other, then you got your race license and all that before that. So it was a really cool thing, and then we don't do it anymore, which is a problem.
Disappointing.
Them kind of race schools, proper race schools, and you had touring car drivers teaching you and all sorts. It was a brilliant experience. And then once you've got your license, you can go, you can do what you want. But
nice.
Even then I was still like, okay, I don't know the first step of what to do, because you're not from that industry. And my father didn't really want me to do it, so it was all on my own. And then I got to around 19 years old, and I just saved up, bought a Formula Ford from the back of the Autosport magazine. Yeah, literally got a bank loan. It was only $3,000 or something, not much. It was a dog of a car. It was a Jayman Formula Ford, but that's not anything bad about Jayman. It was just the condition it was in. And then raced that in 97, and then sold it at the end, made a bit of profit because it had fairly good results, P10, and then moved up Formula Ford again, won that championship this time, and then that was it.
that went was on from two there. Different Formula Fords.
Yeah, same championship. One was a Reynard. Now, these are very old cars. These are like 1988, pre-90 cars.
What engine used to be?
It wasn't the main championship. 1600 Kent. I can't remember the actual engine builder, but yeah, it's the old style.
Wow. Well, I'm amazed.
So that's how it started. So it's just a kid, and I made so many mistakes. So many. It was just me, my friend, my dad, whoever. Can we put the car on the back of a trailer and just take it to the track? So we were so amateurish. It was unbelievable, but so we got through.
So Ford, was your first whole championship or just a few races?
First championship, 97, and then 98, and it was called pre-90. So anything before 1990,
uh-huh.
Basically, anyone could enter.
So this is when your single-seater career started?
Yeah, if you call it a career. It's not really a career.
Well, I think...
I wasn't being paid.
everything what we're doing, I think this is a career.
It was a passion. That's what I wanted it to be at that point. And then Formula 3, which was equivalent to... it was called ARP F3, which is like the F3 Cup that we've got now.
Like a proper F3.
So British F3 was really big them days, and this was cars that were sort of like 7 years old, 6 years old, and you could run them. So that's what I entered then. I only managed to get halfway through the championship before running out of money. And that pretty much was the story from then on. It was always, Enzo's got no money, but I used to go to race teams and just hustle, really, and say, you know, that was the last single seater I raced.
Mm-hmm.
Then it moved into Alfa Romeos and Clio Cup and then GTs. But it was always, I couldn't afford, not even to buy a set of tyres, really. So I had to find sponsors to... You pay for the tyres, you pay this, you pay that, and a good deal from a race team. I just used to knock on the door and say, I've got no money, but I'll win. You know, I was really cocky.
Yeah.
And luckily when they tested me, I would do okay, and they'd say, yeah, we'll give you the seat. But the only problem is if someone comes with money, you're out. You know what I mean? So you're there to raise the profile of the team, get some good results, but... The double edge is if they haven't got the money to do the full season, then they have to put somebody in who calls up. So it's a bit of a business thing, really. It sounds really cocky, actually, when you say it, but it's really, I will come along and get results, help your team stand out, and then attract drivers. But in doing that, you put yourself out of a job. But it was all I could do at the time.
I think if you're doing something, the job, it's not... something what you need to think about. You need to be concentrated only on your passion. I know it from my personal experience as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, listen, but Alfa Romeo, Clio Cab and Super GT, this is all what we call them saloon cars. The club, not open wheel cars.
The open wheel stopped at Formula 3. Mm-hmm. Just the money is ridiculous for that, obviously.
And how was it Alfa Romeo Clio?
It was good, I mean, I just did championships that were club championships, really. So I finished P2 in the Auto Italia. I was winning the Alfa Romeo championship, but again, halfway through the season, the team ran out of money. It was a touring car team, the Alfa Romeo 147.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, they had money to start with, but then it ran out, so I just lost the drive because of that, which is a shame. But we did. We still got that record now, I think.
And after this...
That's a nice car.
After this, Clio happens.
Clio happens, 2002-ish.
All season?
No, half again. British GT, half again. it was just the way it was. And that's why I stopped. It was like, this isn't going anywhere, really.
After British GT.
I'm knocking on 30 years old. It's coming. And actually my coaching, which I think is one of your questions as well, sorry, but
yes.
The coaching started in pretty early, like 98. So I started coaching other drivers and I started to get into mental sciences, silver, NLP.
You said 1998?
Yeah.
So you've been racing and
one
coaching?
Year, yeah. So I coached just gentlemen and things like that. So then coaching was taking off and I was actually getting more of a kick, more of a buzz from coaching. And life coaching and performance, basically, and not so outside of sport as well. So racing was my number one. All of a sudden, over the years, it stopped giving me love, and this one was, and it was an easy transition. Mm-hmm. And I got to the point where even if somebody offered me a drive, I wasn't interested. It was like, no.
You know,
it's quite strange how you can That's a lesson for people, actually, something so important now, believe it or not, you probably experience the same, as you get on, not priorities change, just you find passion in other things, and then this one gets dropped. It's like a new girlfriend.
Yeah, exactly.
But I've stuck with that since. Now I'm 43 years old, and coaching is still my passion, it really is.
But I still want to come back into that period when you used to do and Alpha and Clio, you know, all that. You stepped in the middle, and now as a coach, can you tell me how you motivate yourself? Because, okay, young, understandable, but you stopping halfway through, and it's really, let's say 90% of people would be demotivated.
I was like an animal, honestly. I was just like, next, what's the next opportunity? And so everyone else was saying, what are you doing with your life? You know, the family and that lot. But I was just always, oh, this person's might open the door for me. So it never stopped. Motivation's never been a problem. I think if the goal matches what you really desire and you believe you can do it and you work hard on it and you make small wins all the time, even though it looks like failure from the outside, you're in it and you can see, oh, maybe this person's going to call me back. So I never lost motivation. It just wasn't a thing. I think you lose motivation when you want a big goal or you want something to achieve, but actually truly you know that you're not really getting off your ass to do it. And you're sort of just swimming. And if someone comes along and they say, do this action, and I promise you'll get results, and you will, then you'd be motivated again. I think you just get, it's like when you've got a business, you're just stuck and you're not actually taking any action.
Yeah.
So you're just sort of in a pond, not doing much, just treading water. That's when you lose motivation. But if you wake up every day with a goal for that day and you believe it's taking you closer, that keeps the motivation level high. And I don't need to pump up. It's just, that's just how I operate. Without the goal, without the passion, it's not there anyway.
I agree. Like,
and I want to add a chip on my shoulder. You know, I'm just a working class kid from a council estate, delivering pizzas and working in factories. This was still a lot better than that. So where I'm coming from
is true.
You know what I mean?
And after British GT, you start coaching straight away after British GT. This is when your coach career started.
I would say it was around that. Yeah, it was around that time. It was 2004 when I got my first big gig. And that was to be the BMW, Formula BMW coach. And then that grew to be the chief coach of Europe for BMW. So that's around 2004 onwards. Before that, it was just a driver, individual drivers.
Individual drivers.
Yeah, just learning the craft, what mental techniques work for race drivers. So that takes 6 years of working in that. Oh, and race schools. I was working at race schools here, Silverstone. Every single circuit, actually, Donington, Alton Park, all of them. And that was how I earned money as well. So, and that's coaching general public.
And in 2004, you've been offered the job?
Actually, it was Andy Prio who said, I can't do this one round. Can you be the coach for it? And then I just got on well with the company, BMW, the championship. And then they offered me the job for the following year. So really, it was 2005, but it started in 2004. And then I did 3 or 4 years there before moving to Gravity. Do you remember them? That was a company. It's a bit like Red Bull, but without the product. They paid for drivers to race.
Like a rented drive?
It was basically investment.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So Grosjean was one of ours, Ocon, Marco Whitman. So we got quite big drivers, and I used to coach them and be the sporting manager. And basically, if we saw a driver, we'd pick him and then invest in him and have like 20% or 30% in his career. So it was a proper talent scout company. And then I went on to own Lotus Renault F1. Mm-hmm. So then I started working with that junior squad. It's been a long journey, actually. I think the coaching journey is more impressive than the racing journey. The racing journey was really my entry to it, but then I found my true love was coaching. And that's where my skill is, really, to be fair.
And how do you think the racing journey, is that short? Because you can kind of up to 35, maybe maximum?
Man, you can start at wherever. I mean, if you're thinking F1 and you're thinking, I want to get paid by manufacturers, then starting in your 40s is probably a stretch. Still not impossible for GTs, You can still get paid.
Wow.
But you need, obviously, to get in there, learn it, get the money to race, get good results, and get on with people. Your people skills need to be good, sales skills, and then you never know. You'll have a short career, mm-hmm. but you never know. There was a Clio driver who started when he was 40. I think he won Clios in his second year, and then went to touring cars, and he pole positioned it in his second year in that as well, so... Newsham, I think his name was. Mm-hmm. Probably still going now.
Newsham?
Yeah.
Yeah, started, I remember that.
He started really late, you know. I think he was businessman before that, and some of these gentleman drivers actually are bloody good. They are good. So, yeah, you can start. If you've got the skill, I never want to put an age on it, because we're living to 100 now, right?
That's true. That's
so I never
the oldest
say
one
never.
Was 120.
Yeah, exactly. So, how old are you now?
I am 38.
You're still in the second quarter, mate. If this was a sports match, you're still in the second quarter.
Oh, really?
You know what I mean? Yeah, because you're not even 50.
I'm still good, guys.
If you live to your triple figures, then yeah, you get to 50, you're only half time. So, yeah, I never say never. And actually, there's a 78 year old that raced in Toyota Racing Series. 75 year old.
75, I think.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Kenny, his name is. He's actually a mentor to one of my drivers, and he races still now.
Wow!
So come on, you got ages left.
So now you are working as an individual coach. Am I right?
Yeah.
So this is like for drivers.
Yeah.
Individually.
You got it. But I'm head of performance for WH Sports, which is a sports agency, mm-hmm. and they've got drivers. And basically, I'll look after their drivers. So I if you want to call it a job, that's the only one I've got.
Uh-huh.
Appointment. And then I've got three drivers, which is the Red Bull driver Liam Lawson, Christian Olsen, who we were testing at Silverstone today with, who you quickly met.
Yep.
And Ed Jones, who's in DTM. So I've got three drivers I go round with, but at the minute I'm starting up in London to do executive coaching.
Oh.
So teaching execs and entrepreneurs the same mental skills that race drivers have. So performing under pressure, leadership skills, overcoming adversity, the things that drivers learn naturally are very applicable and cross over to business.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm teaching that. But I've only literally just started. I'm 1 week in. So I'm just building the website and all this sort of stuff. So I've got fingers in different things at the minute, but yeah, it's a busy year. If the virus doesn't hit.
Oh, that virus.
The coronavirus might pause everything.
That virus is everywhere.
Yeah. Afraid so.
even on my phone, it pops up every 5 minutes.
Yeah.
With changes.
Yeah.
I have a question. Like, you do end coaching on the circuit, but at the same time, you do like a mental coaching.
Yep. Yep.
And I am, you know, I looked at the drivers, BTCC, Formula One, DTM, every type of racing has a different psychology.
Yeah.
And because you said that you work and with the single-seater drivers and with DTM.
Mostly single-seaters, yeah.
Mostly, yeah. But it's still different single-seaters, different...
philosophy.
Different philosophy,
yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
How is that works? Like, how you find the needed tools for the different drivers?
What do you think is the one thing that is in common with all of them?
Four wheels and the steering wheel?
No. It's the individual, the person. So, normally, there's probably, let's just say two main things are, Enzo, I know I can do a lap time mm-hmm. in practice, but when it comes to qualifying, I just can't do it. You know what I mean? So that's a mental block that can't perform under pressure. And just that one skill alone, once you perfect that, that combats so many different problems that drivers have. So there's so many different issues that a driver can have that actually it's just one thing. If you change that, all these will change. So actually it's not as technical as you think. It's trying to help the human be at their best. And obviously because I was a driver, I can help them with the data and translate what that means in the car. Then we can visualize that change, so that's more mental. Or I just sit on the side of the track, which I've done forever, and you just take one look and you can see what they're doing wrong. You can see that in any car. So it sounds like it is very broad, but actually it's very, everyone's very similar. I've worked with people on the brinks of F1 to go-karters, and it's the same stuff. It's the same thing that you're teaching. Some of them might have different things, like they're not very good with people. So they go in there and they're shy. So then, okay, all I've got to do with that kid or that driver is teach them how to be confident. And that's probably going to help other areas of their life as well. Because I did life coaching for quite a bit. I qualified in life coaching. And so that's when it comes down to them getting over personal issues. That's another area. So it sounds like a lot, but actually after 23 years or whatever of coaching, you see pretty much every problem. And if you train them in that area, you get good at it. And if I can't do it, I'll pass it on to an expert elsewhere. But usually it's partly driving, watch how they're driving, but really it's can they perform on demand and be at their best? And that's where I'm qualified, should we say.
So actually you and the racing coach, and plus you are kind of psychologist, you need to understand their characters.
It's anything performance. Anything that affects their performance is what I'm usually into. And if it's physical, then we'll get a fitness coach to do that side of things. You know what I mean? So me, it's just performance coach. How can I make this kid drive better? Is it mental or is it physical, as in what they're doing with the car, technique? If so, then we've got the answers for them too.
You know, we don't have this question. I don't have this question on the list, but I just now came up with this question because this is actually my problem. Because when I am racing, I'm every time. I don't want to now bring you back into your working atmosphere. You know,
this is every day for me. I told you I love doing this anyway. So you go for it.
It's really interesting for me because when I'm racing and someone passing me, then I'm sure the other 10 drivers will pass me as well because I am already like, that's it.
Yeah.
You know?
That's interesting.
Yeah. How you can work with yourself, like, you know, I have to get back to this guy.
First of all, there's a process to this. Now, this is a sort of process that we'll do every time. You get the driver to explain the problem. First of all, you have to really install pain. So they're like, I can't do this anymore, it's going to be the end. And you get them to tell you all the reasons why they must change. What's the worst case scenario if you keep bloody doing this? So they do it, they write it down, they tell me, and they have a big list of, God, if I keep doing this, in 1 year's time, I'm finished. And we make that as painful as we can, disgraceful. Some people even cry because it's like, shit, it is actually going that way. Then you flip it, say, okay, if we were to have a magic wand and we sorted this out and people overtake you and you stay strong, and then you perform better, what would that mean in your career? And you paint a picture of how great it could be. So you got two scenarios, right? Mm-hmm. If I overcome this and if I don't, that's motivation. This is how you get people to stop smoking, right? So that's motivation. So that's the very first. The brain goes, I must do this. So first of all, you got to get into that stage. That's half the battle. They're determined, I've got to do it. So then next time they go in the car, that's one of the goals. It's not a goal to get P3, it's a goal. I want to stay mentally clear. I want to be confident throughout the whole race. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that then you change the way they're looking at it, and then actually they get a better result anyway, which is great. But then you give them a technique of, let's see what this person's thinking when you're in that state. When you're worried, what other thoughts, and you get them down. Okay, how are you holding the body? Can you remember? You say, oh yeah, I'm a bit like this. How is your breathing, do you think? Where's your vision? What are you looking at? I'm looking in the mirror. And you basically have a recipe for creating that emotion of fear, or whatever that emotion is. And then again, we flip it. When have you been at your absolute best? And you say, oh yeah, it's Snetterton, August 2012, whenever. Okay, we're going to recreate that. What were you thinking? And they'll be like, I don't remember, I don't think I was thinking anything. Where do you think you were looking? I was just looking ahead. What was your breathing like? I think it was relaxed. My body was relaxed. It just felt good. It's like, okay, brilliant. We've got two recipes. This is the goal now. So we need to physically, when you're in that situation, do not fall for what you're doing before looking in the mirrors. It's have a keyword that breaks what you normally do, breaks you out of it. You just shout to yourself, next, which makes you look at the next corner. Breathe. And you're bringing back the person who's resourceful. And you do that a few times, and the brain goes, actually, this is better. Now I feel I'm in control. Now I'm not looking in the mirror all the time and getting stressed. So basically, you're directing their focus on what to focus on when they're at their best. You make their body also say it. which is how you create an emotion.
So we actually,
that's just how you create an emotion. If I said to you, behind that door, there's somebody who's deeply depressed, how would they be sat? If they were sat down behind the door, how would you think they would be sitting if they were really depressed?
Something like,
yeah,
like
what's
that.
What's the breathing like?
I think it's going to be very deep breathe out
slow,
and short in.
Facial expression?
Sad.
Yeah. Now, everyone knows what it looks like. Now, what sort of thoughts would they be thinking, do you think?
Oh, bad. Really bad and disappointing.
Why me? All this.
Yeah.
Brilliant. That's it. You've created. You're focusing on this and you're holding that body position. Equals, it's a mathematical thing, equals depression or sad. Right? Sadness. Now, if you were to say somebody's just won the lottery, they're behind that door, they're ecstatic, how would they be sat in the chair?
We would hear them.
Yeah, exactly. And it is, I know it sounds like fake it before you make it, but it's not. It's like we create emotions through habits, and it's like you'll just know somebody that they're like this, and that you know what state they're in. So in the car, you don't allow yourself to get stressed, tight, and not breathing anymore. You say, okay, how did I do it when I was relaxed? Oh, I just did that. I put a smile on my face. Oh my God, that's a game changer. If you get someone going down the straight with a big smile on the face, it's just the brain's going, what the hell does this mean? And you tell it next. It starts to think, oh, this is quite good. And it's so simple, it's ridiculous, but we've been doing it naturally all our life. So we've mastered it. We can get to depression when we want to. We do it often. We can get to happiness when we want to. We listen to certain music. So it's playing with these things. It's like, okay, what I focus on and how I hold my body is paramount to how I feel. So if I do that when I'm in the car, warm up with this in mind when you get in the car and access it when you need it. So I feel nervous, right? You got a speaking gig, feel nervous. You find yourself do that, I'm doing it. If I wanted to feel powerful, what would I have to do? I'd have to think different. I'd have to say, right, this is a good opportunity. I could be dead now. This is my one life, my one shot at life. And then your brain starts to get into grateful mode. Mm-hmm. And then you start to sit strong, breathe full, with that in your mind, you're not nervous anymore. It's amazing. And the more you do it, the more powerful it comes. And the brain starts to say, I like this better. And then your results get better. So it all backs it up.
Can I now?
Emotions are really important.
Can I now a little bit change topic, but it will lead us back to this topic again.
Yeah.
What you think about today racing, like Formula One, BTCC,
yep,
or any, even DTM. I know that DTM a bit left something like it used to be, but it's still different.
Yeah.
What you think about racing today, motorsport today?
I think motorsport today, it's a bit of a challenge, because if you think about it, back in the 50s, 60s, it was a heroic sport. People were dying. It was like being a fighter pilot. It was an extreme sport, really. So everyone used to flock to see it. The drivers were these big, you know, amazing people in their minds. Now sport has lost that, motorsport. So now we're like, oh God, what's the selling point? I don't know, because it's not entertaining to watch either, usually. Mm-hmm. You know, you can do a whole season of F1 and probably three races are epic,
yeah,
and the others are just, okay, fastest car wins. So that's the challenge it's got. You've taken away the danger, which is a good thing, because we're saving lives, obviously. You don't want people to, you know, lose their limbs and things. Fine, no problem with that. But you've got to understand that when you're pushing the frontier, manufacturers are like, right, we need faster. That's quite exciting to watch, that journey. If you've seen the film Ford versus Ferrari.
Oh, yes.
That shows you what it was like. The driver was an engineer. The driver was the mechanic. You know, they needed it to work. We've lost that as well.
Yeah.
Now drivers are getting, do this brake shape that you see on the data, and they can all drive quick, yeah, well done, but they're not professionals, a lot of them. So they have to learn that, but they don't really learn it until they get to F1, and it's a shock. It's like, oh my God, I've got the media on me now and all this, and I've got to now, I'm responsible for the thousands of people that work at the factory. Man, that's a lot to take in. So I think the way we train them doesn't really prepare them. So it's not their fault. Plus, it's millions of dollars and pounds to race now, so you get a different kind of driver. And I mean that in a way that sometimes, and I'm going to say every time, sometimes you get drivers that are not haven't got the grit. So mm-hmm. They've got all the coaches, they've got all everything in place, they've got the best car, they've tested more than anyone else. So they've got lap time, yeah, but it's not really a race driver, in my opinion. And I know it's old school way of thinking, but I must say, they're probably quicker than before, because they can drive fast. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But
only one lap.
One lap. Yeah, but
to be honest,
because they're so young, it's nothing bad on them, because when you get to 25, you change again. No, 21, 25, and you evolve. But a lot of times they've been dropped by the time of 25. So they haven't been allowed to show what they could have been. And people mature differently. Like Verstappen. I remember first seeing Verstappen. I was coaching his teammate in F3. And I saw that kid go through the corner. And just one corner. And I was like, we're screwed. You know what I mean? He was straight away unbelievable at 16. And I was like, he's going to F1. And he didn't have to look at any more. And it wasn't because it was me. Anyone could tell. Because his car had understeer in it a little bit. But he was making it oversteer by using the curb and coming in at different speed and angle and pitch. And I was like, at 16, you know how to do that? That's ridiculous. I didn't even learn how to do that. Or to be that confident at that age. And then you see how he acts. So certain, obviously, drivers, you just can see it straight away. Usually it's the handshake, you know what I mean? You just know they're serious. Esteban Ocon was the same. In fact, there's a lot of drivers I drove with, thankfully, that were like that, because I was on that F1 structure. So they're still there, talented as ever. I'm not saying they're quicker than Jim Clark or Jim Clark's quicker than them, because you can never say that. But it's a different world now. It's so expensive, you're ignoring a lot of the talent that's out there.
Yeah, but can we say that the drivers today are, I mean, in general, like you said, talented. And I really don't understand, what does it mean, talent?
Talent is a myth, actually, yeah.
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 I think in back to 50s,
yeah.
I think this is where is the talent. If we back to 50s, because like you said, the driver was getting on their own risk, with their own passion.
Stopwatch, not data.
Yeah. Yeah. And today...
The long circuits as well.
And today, when I'm looking at the... even Lewis, the 6 world champion, you know, I really want to understand, where is the talent?
Oh, man, he has. He's immensely talented. It's just different now. Before, you had to learn... I know exactly what... I do agree with you, actually. You have to learn through your own experiment.
Yeah.
Like I say, there's no data. There's no one telling you break here and all this back then. And you had to just experiment with the fear. If I do crash, I'm probably going to die or hurt myself or be in a fireball. That is a different kind of person, mate. It's a different sport to that. Now, if they ain't got their hands device on properly or the seatbelt, they'll freak out. And it's not because they're weaker. It's just the industry is like that now. So you don't... A driver will come in, be told exactly what to do. Brake here, do this, turn there, bleed the throttle there, or on the throttle harder, or let the car rotate. They're literally told by the coaches, by the engineers. So there's a little bit less intelligence. Now, I've got a driver, Liam Lawson, this year, and he's got that intelligence. It's so good to watch, because when it's wet, he'll work it out. When the tyres are not very good over a long distance, he knows how to drive it. And I think that's when you spot one that, oh, he could make it. Because he's got that about him. He doesn't need to come in, be told, go out. So he's never a session behind, you know what I mean? He'll find the grip. And I think you learn that, and this is a really good thing to say, actually, believe it or not, in Formula Ford, because he came from that. And I had another driver, Richie Stanaway, he came from that background. Mitch Evans did as well. Wasn't with Mitch Evans, but he was another one. And they come with the car control, and they come with the racecraft, and they've had to probably work on the car themselves a little bit, because over New Zealand's like England was, when we all worked on our own car. So it teaches them some skills. But if you've had a perfect karting career in the best team, you go to Formula 4 in the best team, you go to Formula 3 in the best team, you're not really mastering the craft, should we say. You can still be talented, but you're not mastering.
You're actually now telling the Lewis Hamilton path, because he's got in the karting McLaren.
Oh, then, he had to work, though.
Sorry?
He had to work. He did 2 years in each one on the way up, apart from GP2. I think he's... I'll tell you what's a problem with Lewis. He's got a different persona to the real person he is.
Well, how was that?
I used to work with his fitness trainer, and he'd say, man, he works so hard. He dots every I, crosses every T. He's very spiritual. You know, he's a very kind person, and he does everything correct. And he said, but when you look at him through the media, it's different. And the same with Kimi Raikkonen. Kimi Raikkonen's another one everyone's like, oh, he just drinks and drives and whatever. But actually, I only saw him a few times when I was at Lotus, and he was one of the best engineers I've ever seen or heard about. He sets up the car. He tells them what he wants on that car, and you'd never believe it.
Wow.
So these guys, when you just peel back and don't, because we don't really get to know them apart from the Netflix thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's brilliant. I love that, by the way. Then you get to see a little bit of them, but actually when you're in there and you see them, you realise that the ones that stick around, they've got something special. Even the Barrichellos, Coulthards that people would say were number twos, even though they were great drivers, they contributed to the team in a way that Joe Public wouldn't understand, you know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
Schumacher coming back into Mercedes was probably one of the most vital ingredients to make Mercedes what it was now, but no one says that. You know what I mean?
He forgotten. I mean,
yeah. I mean, he was the one who started and did so much behind the scenes to help towards what it is. And everyone's just like, oh, he's lost it now. It's like, oh. But that, you just got to get used to what people think is not. It's a myth. What you see is a mirage.
Mm-hmm.
What goes behind the scenes is completely different, and it's a business at the end of the day. It's like if someone comes to your life and just judged you quickly, or me, or whoever. Without looking at what's happened, why do this, and they just flippantly do it. But they do it with F1 drivers, obviously.
I think people still make a judgment on what they see.
Yeah.
I mean, on the picture.
Snap judgment.
Yeah. This is what we do, like me personally, when I'm watching any type of race. Of course, I think Formula One is the top chart for the judging.
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
especially these days with all that dust systems, with the Ferrari issue, Red Bull as well involved in all that, you know. And we judge just on what we've been shown.
Yeah.
And I think Formula One, my personal opinion, their mistake, they don't want to show the truth behind the scenes.
Yeah.
That's why they're saying, oh, you're judging only on what you see. Of course we are.
We're not allowed in.
Yes.
That's what could help. I think that Netflix thing does.
Yeah.
More of that kind of thing where you see the soap opera going on behind the scenes and the two teammates, how much pressure there is with Gasly. That was like,
oh, yeah.
The whole story. It's going on all the time. The pressure's immense. It is immense. Because Grosjean once said to me when he first went to F1, because obviously he was judged big time, because he's super fast but crashed quite often at the start of his F1 career. But now that's a talented driver, by the way. He's really good, and he gets a hard time. And he said, if I don't quite smile correctly or as much as I was yesterday, the media will make a story of it. And when you've got people like that doing that all the time to you, Siri is listening. then that affects your game, your performance as well. So it's something that they can't. Yeah, I don't know how I got off onto this, but it is. We do judge, but I wish they would just let us in a bit more. Like IndyCar, you sort of know the drivers a bit more. You can get close to them. Then I think people will fall in love with it again a bit more, rather than it being this.
As a coach, how often are you involved in something like F1 behind the scenes? Like, have you ever been involved in?
Only the junior team. I'm really the person that preps them for that.
Mm-hmm.
Once they learn what I learn, they apply it and they're okay. So I'm really more the junior, and I don't think I really want to travel 21 weekends.
Yeah.
But not at the minute, anyway.
But
yeah, it's all the same.
You know, another question for you as a coach. We take as example again F1, because they have a significant difference between the teams and the cars, setups, lap times and everything. And for example, like I see last year, 2019, I see the Renault, it comes from the past, the Williams team driver, forgot his name. To be honest, he's been driving a slow car. I think George, English guy. George. But he's not losing motivation.
He's another one, mate. He's got talent.
In the F1, is it easy to kill the driver? I speak kill him to chase his dream?
It is, but they're thinking, what else can I do? You know what I mean?
That's true.
It's like, if I lose this, I've got nothing. And it's still their dream to get spotted. He's thinking, right, if I just keep doing it as I am, someone's going to pick me up. Because he's still linked to Mercedes and things, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what helps. And it's like, they still prefer to be in F1 even if it's in a bad car. Because they're there, they're on the market. And actually, the people that can get into F1, it's a very select few, because you need the super license points.
Yeah.
That takes a long time to get. You have to finish like top five main championships consistently to collect 45 points to allow you to race. So actually, you can't just pick a driver up now. If you get an IndyCar champion, they've probably not got enough points. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
well, they
yeah.
might have, I don't know. But if you've just done IndyCar for 3 years and you've sort of finished 10th or whatever, still a good driver, not a great car, whatever the reason is, you still can't race in F1. So it's hard to build them points up. So there's not actually, if they say go away, George, or anything, they're not going to be able to fill the seat very easily. So it's a double thing. So they want him there, even though he's at the back. He'll get his shot.
Yeah. Can you say in your career you had the best driver and you had a driver which you couldn't get along with? Can you say you had the drivers?
Not really. Because I'm there, they want me to help them. It's usually a good relationship. That has to be struck up first. There's drivers that butt heads. There's one who was super fast.
Uh-huh.
Richie Stanaway. You ever heard of him?
Where he
did Formula 3.5. He won German F3. Went and did GP2
mm-hmm.
and Supercar V8s.
Yeah.
Now he's a great. He's one of the best I've worked with as well. And he used to always challenge. If you said something he didn't quite agree with, he'd challenge it. But the relationship was really good. You know, it's nothing to do with relationship. But I like that when a driver's got an opinion. And they think it doesn't make sense, I'm going to do it my way. And that's usually, the more stubborn they are actually, the faster they are, because they care less about what people think about them, they actually perform better. You know what I mean? So it's a good thing and a bad thing. When you've got someone who's always trying to be nice to everyone, they haven't usually got that killer edge. That, you know what I mean? And to be an F1, and Eric Bullier told me this, because I used to work for him, and he said, I choose drivers to be in my team, when he ran the F1 team, who are killers. He says you have to look them in the eye and think they're a killer. And that's how he hired. So he had Raikkonen, he had Grosjean.
Yeah.
You know, people like that. And you can just tell that's the kind of driver that will survive. And now we work with Red Bull. Dr. Marco's the same. He needs someone who is a man. You know, someone who's fast, someone who's trustworthy, obviously, in the car. But he needs a warrior. And they all do, because they won't last otherwise, you'll crumble. The higher you get up, the worse it gets. All them millions being thrown at it.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
but for you, as a coach, you need to find some kind of entrance to the driver to approach him, you know?
Yeah.
But if he is like, no, I disagree, you know? But you know that this is going to be, you're going to be quicker, like... Is that
depends
difficult?
Depends what mood I'm in. Sometimes I'll fight, but other times I go, right, you walk the path you're on now, watch what happens,
uh-huh.
and then come to me when it does.
So you give a chance to make a mistake.
Yeah. Actually, I think that's what I do mostly. It's you make them see it, and they make their own mind up. Otherwise, it's like dad telling a kid, do your homework. You know what I mean? Or eat your greens, or tidy your room. It never really works then. So you need to tell them, you need to show them, but let them learn. And that freaks people out when they're spending money on the driver and they expect you to give them a quick change. It's like, hang on a minute, the kid needs to see it themselves. So we're going to have a few race weekends, I'm afraid, of them doing it incorrect before it clicks. And then they learn. Otherwise, they just ignore it anyway. And it's just it bounces off. They need to learn from here, not just what's being told. That's the best way to teach. I think kids are the same, you know. When you're teaching a kid something. If they burn the hand on the stove, they'll learn. If you tell them not to touch it, then it's not really, they're going to, well, that's a bad example actually, because they'll touch it and they'll hurt themselves.
Yeah.
But usually, you tell a kid not to do something when they're a teenager, they'll do it. You know what I mean? But if you show them why, or they've experienced it in the past, why not a good idea, they won't. It's that philosophy.
What do you think about cheating in motorsport? Because
if you're winning, you're cheating. That's that's basically a saying. Someone told me that, and I was like, no, it's if you're the best driver. But actually, cheating is a bit of a strange way to put it, but it's grey areas. If you're with a top team that's winning all the time, every year, they're doing something that no one else is. And it will be in with the rules, fine, but they're either testing more or they've found a loophole of how to help the car do what no other engineer has figured out over the seasons. So it's motorsport, and obviously you've got to remember motor is in the word motorsport. So if you can get that to perform better and you find something that no other team has noticed and it hasn't even been picked up by the stewards, it's not really cheating because no one else knows about it.
you know what I mean?
Or you found a loophole in the rules or something. But when you say cheating, what do you mean?
I mean, well, we had the last year, we had the situation with the... that was a Ferrari where it was found the issue with the fuel in the carburetor. They made the they made the fuel kind of go through the, not through the line, but also it could go through the outside of line.
Yeah.
And I call these type of cheatings because even now we have a lot of teams want to take to the court FIA for Formula One about not telling what's happening between FIA and the Ferrari,
yeah, Ferrari, yeah.
You know, and it's another kind of cheating because, I mean, okay, we don't know the issue, but you cheat with us. You don't give us the issue reason, like what's happening, why happening with the Ferrari every time. You're finding an agreement, but no one knows what kind of agreement, how this agreement was settled. You know,
F1's very different. It's like, it's cutthroat. It's everyone doing business. It's everyone looking for innovation, try this, try that. And people are being paid, you know, a lot of money to find out different ways of doing the fuel, doing everything.
Yeah.
So you're going to trip up now and then. And it's political as well. So it's, you know what, when you're on the outside, you can't even comment on it because you don't know the backstory. I can't comment. You don't know the backstory. You don't know what's happened. Maybe so-and-so slept with their wife and they exposed them, you know what I mean? There's so much that goes on that looking from the outside, it's hard to have... You can have an opinion, but I know it's going to be flawed. And I learned that early on when I was within the F1 rank, the junior squad. People would judge things and you're like, yeah, but you just don't know the story. And I can't tell you either. So, mate, there's probably more to it. There always is. So
I agree with
who
you.
Who knows? So I hate having opinions on things I don't know about.
I think
cheating is basically they're pushing the boundaries. They've got to win. So much on it. They've got to win. So you're going to do things now and then that you think are fine because you're in it. But then the stewards or someone will say no. And then it's a marketing disaster if we get found out. Can we just keep it quiet? And you know what I mean?
Yeah,
there's so much to at stake.
Yeah.
And you've got to keep them happy, Ferrari, because if they leave... It's a big part of F1 gone. They know that.
It's a history gone.
Exactly.
Formula One.
Exactly. Big following. So everyone is... Let's just say everyone's making the best decision they can in their position. But obviously, because you've got conflicting views and needs and wants, it's never going to be... No one's ever going to be happy. Not everyone.
True.
So it's really technical, mate, to talk about.
Can you tell me... top three drivers which you think, doesn't matter any type of racing, which you think is, let's use that word, really, really talented.
Sebastian Loeb. Obviously, I don't know why, but he is. And I'm going to go on two wheels for Travis Pastrana.
Two wheels?
You ever heard of Travis Pastrana?
To be honest with you, no, never heard. But you speak about two wheels motorbikes.
Yeah. And Valentino Rossi.
Rossi, I know.
God, mate, I could name more than three. And everyone's different in their own way. You know what I mean? They're skilled and they... Senna, obviously. You got all the greats. So I like to look also at drivers that didn't make it, that have never been heard of in the big ranks. And it's people like, and you might know him, Stefan Hodgett. You ever heard of that name?
I heard that name, yes.
This is a kid, I grew up with him, same town we lived in. And he's he did a bit of single-seater, but didn't get a proper go at it. So we don't know how good he was in them ranks. But when it comes to anything tin-top or anything else, he's nearly untouchable.
Wow.
Yet he didn't make it. So you could have put him in touring cars. He was in touring cars for a very short time, but you could have put him in there now and he'd be right up the front. No problem. So there's these kind of drivers where I see them and I think, Adam Carroll's another one, you know what I mean? There's lots of drivers that have got the skill to... You just plop them in F1, they probably would have been okay. But we never get to see them.
Yeah.
And that Richie Stanaway is another one. He broke his back just at the wrong time in a big crash. And that completely changed his career path, but he was destined to go all the way. There's tons of them, mate. There's so many, for different reasons, as I say.
And because you mentioned Ayrton Senna, you know, and
he's the biggie, obviously. He's the big one.
Yeah, he like.
It's easy to say.
Sometimes I'm thinking that he been made like a media person. You know, he every TV series or anything always involved Senna, Ayrton Senna name.
Yeah.
You know, but then there is another guy who was the same year, the same age, won the same championship. There was the Irish guy, Tom Byrne.
Oh, Tom one year Byrne. Before.
Yes.
One year before.
Yes.
I saw that.
Yeah. You know what? I think reputation in a Formula One, in a racing, plays big difference. Because Tom Byrne, it was some kind of James Hunt part two, you know?
Yeah.
He was really that guy.
Yeah, and if you're... He said it himself, my face didn't fit, or I didn't have the character to get on with people, or didn't play the political game. I'm afraid in business, which... Motorsport's business, you can't... It's not a sport. Apart from the driver being in the car, everything else is business. You need to get on with everyone and win them over. You need to be a salesman. You need to look the parts. You know, all this needs to be there, I'm afraid. It's just the way it is when you're talking to manufacturers, because you're a brand. They're going to stick their label on you. You've got to fit. You know what I mean? You can't embarrass them. You can't crash the car too often. So if you're fast, yeah, that's a quality. Mm-hmm. But if you're fast and we don't really get on with you, no. We prefer someone who's 1/10 slower, 2/10 slower, but he's the perfect commercial machine, because we're here to sell cars.
He's used to
you
the
know what
brand.
I mean? So that's why you get a difference in
so
opportunity.
That means in motorsport, your past, well, literally, to be in the motorsport, you need to start working on your on your story since 6 years old.
Well, yeah, obviously that's hard.
Because Ayrton started from four, and I think Ayrton been lucky to born in a family where dad already, I think, he's kind of draw his future.
Yeah, yeah.
He knew who Ayrton needs to be, how he needs to be.
Yeah.
And I think the same story with Lewis, where the dad was really...
And Max Verstappen.
Max Verstappen.
It helps.
But what to do if you are 16 and you're like, oh, racing, I love it.
Then it's down to, you do need some kind of DNA. You do need some kind of raw ability that you have already.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't got the cash as well, then you need to be a good salesperson to get sponsorship and all that. So it's a tough ask at that age. Like I say, you only really figure things out in your 20s, 30s, 40s, 16. It's hard to say to someone, right, go out there and find 750,000 to go and race. It's like, oh, what? If dad can't pay it, where do you start? So it's difficult to do that. When they're given an opportunity, and even with Hamilton, it was like his dad had to work two or three jobs to pay for it. So he saw that. He's got the work ethic. So I think if you've got the work ethic at 16 and you can sell and you do have some ability behind the wheel, that's important when you eventually get it. There's nothing stopping you, really. F1, who knows? You just have to be lucky and win the right race. The right person sees it and they give you a shot. I would never say no, it's too late then. But there are some drivers, you know, they do start a bit later. They haven't gone through everything. So they do exist. If they're really good and they just hit the right spot at the right time, it's always possible. And the GT route and Le Mans and IndyCar, you can start much later.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
So there's always them options.
In your coaching career, with the drivers with whom you work, every driver improved?
Yes. Yeah. I'd like to say yes. They didn't get worse, that's for sure. I don't think so, anyway. I mean, some are tough, some is difficult. You can go a whole season and it's incremental, but it builds after that. So it's a slow process. Some, bang, thanks Enzo, I've done one session, don't need you again. So everyone's different, you know. Because we measure it, right? We measure everything they're doing. It's hard not to prove it. And if it isn't working, I'll just walk, you know, say it's not working. But luckily, touch wood, up to now, we've always made a difference in some way. And they've always performed that bit better. So let's keep that going. But I think I put myself under as much pressure as they do.
Yeah.
So I'm going towards a race weekend thinking, right, how can I make him improve? What can we simplify everything down to this one thing we can improve this weekend and then just focus on that? And that's my job, to focus on that and help him score that area at the end of the day. So then then you can't really not improve because you're constantly going.
What is the most difficult when you're starting to learn that starting craft, or when you're already in the top time to polish that 1/10th, 1/1000th? What is the most difficult?
That bit, the end.
The end.
Because I see drivers in F1 now that I remembered either have worked with or I've seen them in the same team, and they're making the same mistakes they made then. You know what I mean? So the start of it, they're making progress. It's like any sport, you make big progress. Then you get a plateau, and then it's just polishing the other areas. But usually you see that the same traits are kind of there. Like, yeah, I remember him when he was in F3, he was exactly the same. So it shows you that it does that, and you hit your peak.
Is that happening?
Just polishing gently, but really, you can tell really how far they're going to go.
Is that happens because the driver hit his peak, or because he's like...
That's him. That's his character. That's where I'm at.
That's him, yeah?
Yeah.
He like, okay, I reached my peak, and that's it. And he kind of like not worry to just hit that wall, you know, to go further.
People like to think in motorsport, everyone can be as fast as everyone, but it's not true. It's in here, feeling the car, what to do, not having to be told how to drive, figuring it out in the wet. All of a sudden it's wet, what are you going to do about it?
Don't you think...
But you do hit your sort of base. You can refine it and get better and have different kind of trainers and things like this and get slightly better, yeah, of course. But that is more difficult than, now I'm going to chunk 1 second off because I'm 4 seconds off. That's the easy bit.
Yeah. You know what I found? That people, they like that kind of feeling of stability. And it's not only on motorsport. If we took the regular person, he grow up, he's going to school, 12 years wasting in school.
Yeah.
Then he's going to university. Then he's getting a job. Then he's like, okay, I need my salary up to 4K. And that's it.
Yeah.
And he don't want to push any boundaries.
Yeah.
And I mean, don't you think that there's some motorsport people there the same?
Yeah, that's actually in the car as well. You know, it's fear. Fear of consequence. If I take this corner flat, what's that going to do? Is it going to scare me? Will it have a crash that's going to cost us a load? Yeah, you are going to... It's comfort zone, isn't it?
Yeah.
You hit a comfort zone, and in motorsport, it's less... It's still there, of course, but it's less prominent because you're in a sport that you are on the edge. And you're there on your own fighting in front of everybody, so you're exposed. As soon as you come into the pit lane, you've got a team of people all pointing at where you're not good enough and where you can improve. You're not usually saying this is good, it's usually got to be better there. So actually, it kind of breeds you to be outside your comfort zone a little bit. But no, that's a human... behavior that's everywhere.
Enzo, I want to touch the final topic, which we had already, and on my channel and lots on your channel. You don't mind if I mention your channel in
Absolutely.
The description?
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Guys, I will leave in the description down below a link for Enzo Mucci channel, so you can go and you can check lots and lots of interesting information about racing, about mental preparation. Just go and check it, guys.
The Race Driver Coach Show, it's called. It's a bit of a long title.
Yeah.
Wasn't on purpose.
Yeah, so the last which I want to chat about is budget.
Oh.
And the first question which I have, do you think Formula One, are they doing correct in 2021, putting everyone under the restricted budget?
I like that.
Yeah?
That reminds me of Fantasy F1, Fantasy Football. Have you seen that? Where you can choose a team and drivers.
Oh, yes.
You get 100 million and spend that. Yeah, it's a very complicated version of that. But the problem is, how do you police it? How do you make sure that they're all spending that money?
Exactly.
It's more cheating that's going to go on. Of course I like it because I think it's way too expensive for a kid to get into racing now. I want to go F1. It's like, okay, you got to be fast. And you also need... 10 mil, and it's like, or somebody needs to put that kind of money up for you
just to get there.
Yeah. That's if it's quite easy. F3 now is nearly a million. It's going up to euros.
Wow.
It's going up to that. And that's like, that's probably your second or third year of racing. So you've done F4 for a quarter of a million, maybe nearly half if you're doing two F4 championships. So you're like, you're still learning, and you've spent $2 million, nearly, one and a half, and all the other stuff, coaches and transport and blah, 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 getting there. And then F2 is nearly $2 million, and then that's if you do 1 year in each one, but you're not probably going to do two.
Just a second, you said...
crazy money.
You said in 1994 you bought your first...
Formula Ford.
Formula Ford, which is equal to Formula 3 now.
No.
Ah.
Formula Ford is still now going around. It's more... it's just a 1600, not even on slicks. It's not, you know, it's a...
it's on a treaded tyre.
It's what Senna did. Back in the day, you had Formula Ford, Formula 3, F1. Nearly. It's mm-hmm. a little bit... yeah, that's pretty much what you had. Now you've got numerous. You've got Formula Renault, you've got F3 Regional, British F3.
Yeah.
F4s, you got all sorts. So it's a bit different now. So there's not really an easy category. On the very mainstream, F1, F2, F3, that's easy to follow. But then underneath that, it's still take your pick. But they're all expensive. Now, Formula Ford, you can do it nationally for quite a good price. Let's say you can do it for 50K. All year, right?
Yeah,
and it's kind of doable if you've got a good job and your dad's got a good job and you can eke your way through. If you prepare the car, it's cheaper. If you buy the car for 15, 20 grand, you can sell it for 15, 20 grand. You know what I mean? So maybe the sponsor can own the car. So there's different ways you can do it at club level or national level. But it's just when you go international, that's when it gets a bit sticky.
But you're not able anymore to buy like you did for $3,000.
No. It's equivalent. Because remember, that's 20 years ago. More than that. So it is kind of equivalent. So, okay, I could get a bank loan and I saved up as well. Believe it. Even for that amount of money, because I had to run the thing and get a trailer and all this and get a mechanic to help me take the car to a mechanic before a race weekend to get it ready. Because I couldn't really do that very well. But yeah, you can still do that. Like Mazda MX-5s. I've said this on my show. Mazda MX-5 is like 20 grand for the season. That's amazing.
That's
it's like
cool.
60 cars. It's brilliant. So
we
you
speak
can
about
still,
Mach 1.
Yeah, actually, I asked them about the Mach 3.
Oh, 2.0.
Yeah, and I said, what's the difference in price? And they went, you know what? The running cost is the same, just the car's a little bit more expensive, like tiny. So I was like, well, do that. If you do that instead, because it's a nicer, prettier car. BMW compact series is it called?
Yes.
Still about 20k. Caterhams you can do fairly cheap. So there's actually in Britain this is. We're very lucky. Because we've got a race circuit virtually 1 hour, every 1 hour of driving.
True.
It's easy to get around. Like in America, if you say right, this week we're in LA, next week we're in Florida. Exactly. So we're really lucky in England where you can race for actually a working man's wage. It is possible. It's not the F1 route, but it gets you in there. If you get good results, you never know where it ends up.
Yeah.
On the GT route or anything else.
Because you said about US, yeah, and here, UK, you know what? If we speak about the budget, I don't know why, but US can make out of nothing something interesting. Like a NASCAR. You know, NASCAR, it's a... round, you know, oval racing, but the way how they're making it, I think BTCC need to take it as a kind of example.
Yeah, they're
know?
The giants when it comes to sponsorship. They're the best in
yes.
the industry.
Yeah,
they really are. They're still struggling now, or they're feeling the pinch, but they've got it down. They do lots of business to business because there's like 40 companies on your car, all the small ones and big ones. They can do business with each other, maybe with another team, with the actual championship help by saying, okay, you're sponsored by McDonald's, you're sponsored by Holiday Inn, let's do an offer for all the customers. And so they're really switched on that front. They've got a team of people that work on it.
But why why here in a country where is the motorsport, it's kind of mother country for the motorsport, because we have we have AMG, we have India for it's Point
I
forgot the name. Then we have a Virgin Racing, Racing Point. We have nearly 80% of the Formula One cars manufacturers here. But we are so
on the commercial side.
Bad on the commercial side. I mean, we are so bad on the finding sponsor. For me personally, when I'm looking, I'm coming to the companies, I'm saying, listen, I want to start from the scratch, my motorsport. I have my YouTube channel and this and that. And I said, I can offer you the advertisement on my social media or something like this, you know. And it's not much interest.
Because it doesn't equal sales. I sponsored... Another thing I did once is I owned a dating website. And it was just like, this is what happens when you finish racing, everybody. When you can't race anymore, you're just trying to do anything. But I was coaching, but still, I was like, oh no, dating website. And I should have stuck with it because now they're massive. but I didn't. I failed miserably at it. But still, I sponsored a car on the Toka package and got two nice girls to walk around getting everyone's emails, because you could do that then without GDPR. And... I got probably 500 more members on the website, but didn't give me anything. Luckily, I did a deal with the driver, because I lived with him. And we were flatmates, housemates, and he put me on there for next to nothing. But if I had paid 10 grand for that, it got me nothing, really. And that's the problem. It doesn't equate. If it's not done correctly, it can, obviously. If it's not done correctly, you put a sticker on the car... Yeah, it looks nice, but it's not made me any richer as a company, unless I need exposure for that kind of spectator or something, or it's another deal, a B2B deal, or you're actually allowing people to test my product if it's a drink or something. So some things fit, but some don't. But actually, the way we look now, I think there's more benefit on doing Facebook advertising. You know what I mean? We've got so many options as companies, but as a philosophy and a mentality of the way companies are in this country, we're not really that emotional about motorsport.
Why?
I don't know. It's a bit boring.
I mean, I've been shocked. I've been shocked when on BTCC in 2000, not 10 or 11, I've seen eBay as a sponsor of. I think it was BMW team. It was eBay, and I was like, eBay, who is gathering all businesses in under one wing, can afford sponsored racing, but that businesses can't? Like,
I don't know what they might be getting something different. It honestly, sometimes the sponsorship, they're doing a business deal with somebody, completely separate to motorsport, and it's like, you know what, I will order more products from you if you just give us your stickers on the car and a bit of money. I'll make sure that we'll stay with you next year as well. There's so much that goes on. If you just sponsor my son, I will order from you for the next 5 years. You know what I mean? If it's a supply deal.
Ah.
So there's a lot. It's everyone's different again. So it's not like... but the value is, for a sponsorship to be on a car is not worth much. You know what I mean? So the budget is 100 grand, say, to pay for the car for the season. But sticking that on your social media and their branding, it's probably worth 10.
Wow.
You know what I mean? The actual value. The actual value what they're getting. So they're not stupid. They're like, no, it's not
so
worth
actually
it.
To
so
be
NASCAR, how exposed it is, racing 30 weekends of the year or whatever they do, that's a lot of exposure. There's a lot of interaction. It makes sense. Mm-hmm. Now, working with this WH Sports agency, they sell a lot more in football. They sell on F1 as well, sponsorship, this is what they do. But putting a company here on Ronaldo's shirt, or anyone else, Atletico Madrid, which they've got one there, that's worth a lot more. And you can show them, when the match is on, your website activity goes through the roof. You can actually show them.
Ah.
On racing, you'd be lucky if you got 3 more viewers on your website.
That's true.
It's not working.
That's true.
It can work if it's designed better, it's got more exposure. F1 works just about, because it's got mass exposure. But if it hasn't, then it's no commercial value to a company. They'd be silly to do it, you know what I mean? If they like motorsport, then maybe they'll make sense of it. Mm-hmm. It's if they only like golf and they like football, and you come with motorsport, they're like, no. So it's a hard sell.
So can we say that to be here in UK racing driver, you need to be a quite good businessman?
Absolutely. In life.
Because when I looked at the BTCC, lots of them are not only racing drivers, they're businessmen.
Yep, yep.
Like Rob Collar.
Collar. His son is here.
Oh, really?
He's just behind the door, yeah.
So everything connected.
Yeah. Jordan Collard, he's here. You've got to be switched on, and that's when you win people over. Senna was an awesome business person. And I think I showed you, didn't I, that quote. And I can't quote it now because I don't know the exact words. Uh-huh. But how Frank Williams explained or described Senna was all about his negotiation skills as a business person. He didn't even mention about his driving. It was like, that's what I remember him for. Like, oh, God, okay. So again, you don't realise what skills these people have got. They know they have to get as many people to say yes as they can to get them in that car. So you've got to be good with people and sell it. And Andy Priot's another one. He didn't have much money at all. And he came over from Guernsey with a caravan, parked up at Silverstone, lived in the caravan for over a year. No money, but he ended up, because he was really good at sales and doing deals with people and just working basically hard on it. He used to have this thing where he said, right, I have to ask 300 people before I get one yes. That was his rule. So when you know that, can you imagine how hard you work every day? You learn business. You learn how to, okay, you want that. I know someone who can do that. Can you pay me as a middleman? So then you get into it. And then he got to F3. He was triple world touring car champion, F1 test driver for Williams and BMW. So it's like, and he came over in his 20s. So that shows you it's never too late. And he didn't even have a history on track. So that, again, that's why I say never. And I think the fashion might change. The fashion might be, you know what, I don't want young kids anymore. BMW say this all of a sudden, or Ferrari. We want more older generation, because that's our target market. So we're going to start to select drivers that are older. Who knows?
Who knows? Yeah,
yeah, exactly. So it can be a fad thing, you know, but yeah. Have one fast young one and then one older one, then this person who started when they were 19 is in, if they're good.
Yeah.
You can't forget that.
You know, now when you explain me about the business situation, it's more clear picture in my head now.
Yeah.
And because our conversation comes to the end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
10-minute conversation. Never is.
Yeah.
That's my fault, sorry.
Final words to the, I don't think that to the young drivers, beginners, or doesn't matter, just to the drivers who is willing to get into something more. I think any type of motorsport is already professional if you're doing this.
Yeah.
But the people who is building their step ladder in motorsport, final words, what you, maybe recommendations, maybe suggestions.
Yeah, if I could do it again.
Yes.
Like what I'd do. Obviously, the shortcut is hard to trust anyone, because everyone, a race team's there, they know you're only there for a year, so they just basically take your money and you're on for the next, and you're the same as a driver. So it's trying to get people that you really trust to help you out. That takes time, I'm afraid. It's knowing that you need to be good at business. So if you, I haven't got the money, but I know I need to be good at business, maybe I should do a sales course or something, get good on that side. And to get racing is really simple. Get your race license and go race, but you just got to raise the funds for it. So it's, how can I, even if you get 20 sponsors giving $2,000 each, come up with, I need this much. Don't go for a championship that's too big. Go for a really small championship that's $20,000 and learn how to sell that. And once you've got $20,000 and you've got it through sponsorship, you're like, that's brilliant. I did it. Now all I have to do is add a bit more value, put the price tag up, and I can go and sell a bigger championship. So I think, and I said it in a really early video, is start, dream big, but start small. Don't think, right, I'm going to be F4, because you'll fail getting $250,000. It's, I need to learn the vital skills to go racing. And don't be posh, I need to go and do this championship. No, do a really crappy championship, but just get on the track, learn the skills, and that's it, and it doesn't need to cost much. If you can do it under $20,000. If you prepare the car yourself, if you buy the car for like $10,000 or whatever and sell it for $10,000 at the end of the year, you just got to get it there entry fees, race kit, it's not actually that much. And don't crash, because that costs more then. It costs more.
And at the end, I have a super question. This is the last question. You can answer it short, you can answer it long.
Yeah.
If God would exist, would you choose to give away everything what you have today and do one season in a race which you prefer? It can be Formula One or whatever what you like.
A wish, you mean? Yeah.
Yeah. Would you choose that, or would you keep the same like you do now?
Same. Absolutely. I think I get much more of a buzz helping driver, watching them. I'm a wreck when my driver's driving. I'm more nervous than they are. So I get that buzz there. And I think contribution, because when you're a driver, it's all selfish, all you. That's great. But you get to a certain age where you think, actually, I feel more power in sharing it. And actually, that's when you help a driver and you watch them go off and succeed. Man, it's powerful. You help someone overcome depression or something like that, it's powerful. That sort of stuff is more. When I'm driving a car now, it's like, yeah. You know what I mean? It's a bit flat. So no, I want to keep it as it is.
Nice one. Enzo, thanks a lot for this chat.
Thank you, everyone.
Amazing.